同志们，Comrades，
现在我代表第十九届中央委员会。On
behalf of the 19th Central Committee of the Communist Party of China, I will now deliver a report to the 20th National Congress.
第二十次全国代表大会。The
20th National Congress of the Communist Party of China is a meeting of great importance. It takes place at a critical time as the entire party and the Chinese people of all ethnic groups embark on a new journey to build China into a modern socialist country in all respects and advance towards the second centenary goal. The theme of this Congress is holding high the great banner of socialism with Chinese characteristics, fully implementing the thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era, carrying forward the great founding spirit of the party, staying confident and building strength, upholding fundamental principles and break new ground, forging ahead with enterprise and fortitude, and strive in unity to build a modern socialist country in all respect and advance the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation on all fronts.
中国共产党已走过百年奋斗的征程。Since
its founding a century ago, the Communist Party of China has taken a remarkable journey. Our party has dedicated itself to achieving lasting greatness for the Chinese nation and committed itself to the noble cause of peace and development for humanity. Our responsibility is unmatched in importance, and our mission is glorious beyond compare. It is the imperative that all of us in the party never forget our original aspiration and founding mission, that we always stay modest, prudent, and hardworking, and that we have the courage and ability to carry on our fight. We must remain confident in our history, exhibit greater historical initiative, and write an even more magnificent chapter for socialism with Chinese characteristics in the new era.
I'm taking over. All right. Well, Fayon, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what you think Americans should understand about the 20th Party Congress, you know, how it functions and why this is important. I mean, is this something that is an atypical happening in China or part of a regular process?
Yeah, so I think the best frame of reference for Americans is that what happened in China is pretty analogous to the Democratic or Republican national conventions that the parties hold in election years. That combined with probably a State of the Union. So basically every 5 years, the members of China's National Party Congress, they get together. They basically review the progress of the last five-year plan. They confirm the members of the Standing Committee for the next 5 years, and they basically lay out, this is our plan for the next 5 years. These are the policy goals that we hope to achieve. And this is, you know, why we believe these things are necessary. So it is what happens in America too. When you go to these conventions, you see the parties lay out their platform. The only difference is there's a lot more accountability in China, because what you said 5 years ago, well, you were in power those 5 years and you have to see how you measured up against those goals. Whereas I think our memory here in the United States is a little shorter. And I don't know that anyone could tell you what was in Biden's 2020 platform or his progress toward those. You'd probably have to do a little bit of digging to get to that. Instead, our coverage is mostly just about like the day-to-day sniping and who said what on what political talk show.
Yeah, that seems like a really different kind of process. I'm trying to imagine, party platforms in the United States acting as a series of promises and goals rather than, you know, sort of like an aspirational platform that is, you know, intended to get voters to, you know, cleave to a particular party and show up to vote. but isn't really intended to be a series of promises that will be delivered. I think we, you know, approach all those things with a great deal of skepticism from the outset, which, you know, I think is a really different kind of system that we have here. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about how Chinese leaders evaluate their own performance, you know, in between these five-year party congresses. Is there something that happens on an annual basis? Or are they just creating reports? How do they know whether they're meeting their targets?
Yeah, so there's an annual plenum that they meet together, and they tend to evaluate the policy goals there, as well as like if there are any major changes. Like COVID, for example, is one that definitely had a significant impact on whatever plan was made in the previous party Congress, right? And there had to be a lot of changes to account for that, and the disruption in the path forward for China's pandemic response. But beyond that too, like it's such a large country, and although these goals are set at like the country level, filtering that down to each province and then each city, each locality, there's a lot of work that also needs to go down there. And like once after the Congress concludes, then it's really up to the party members in each province and city to start the work of translating, okay, what does this policy goal mean for us? What's our role to play in getting to make sure that, you know, we do our part to help the country meet this like goal of green energy or economic growth or, you know, healthcare coverage, et cetera. So, you know, it does also take a lot of bureaucratic movement too. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that goes on in the years between these policy plans to turning those high level goals into detailed, concrete things to do at the local level.
I'm curious to what extent, you know, how are, you know, leaders either rewarded or, you know, face consequences for not meeting the goals, whether at the provincial level or at the national level? The idea of accountability here is so murky. I feel like no matter how badly politicians screw up, you know, as long as they retain sort of the loyalty of their party, there isn't really any accountability here for not delivering on policy goals.
Yeah, so there's for very clear cut cases like corruption or taking bribes, things like that. You know, there's dismissal, trial, jail time. That all happens pretty regularly in China, and you know, it's well known in China that corruption definitely was a very big problem, especially in the years right after accession to the World Trade Organization, which happened in 2001. And possibly that 10 years there where there's just kind of an explosion of foreign capital entering China and building out all of these factories, like outsourcing manufacturing. That era produced a lot of those kind of negative effects. And in the past 15 years or so, they've made a lot of progress cleaning that up. So that sort of accountability, that's just a very basic, like, you know, you can't be a corrupt official if you want to be in the party. But there's also evaluations based on performance too. Previously, we saw that like party officials in cities where like outbreaks had gotten out of hand were sacked. Now, they weren't jailed or anything, because it was just performance based. But yeah, party officials get sacked for poor performance all the time. Mayors, provincial governors, etc. There's no need to wait till an election and see if the other party can put up a less corrupt candidate or a more convincing candidate for accountability to happen.
Maybe you could tell us also a little bit more about, you know, who gets to go and serve at the CPC Congress. Who can participate? Is it open to anyone? Do you have to be elected? What is like the selection criteria, and are people at some level, you know, voting members into the Congress?
Yeah, so it starts at the grassroots level, like people who are interested in being a member of the Communist Party of China, being a party member and the work that entails that membership. You have to apply, and the acceptance rate is not very high. But for people who get in, there's a lot of requirements. There's meetings. There's like work to be done. There's like organizing that goes into that, and you kind of just work your way up the ranks. And like local parties will select delegates that go up to like higher level meetings, provincial congresses, etc. And then like that all filters up, and these larger groups select delegates, and that finally go to the National Party Congress. And so that's how you get people really from all walks of life attending the party congress. There's people who are well known for inventing Lalgadma, which is like a chili crisp sauce. She's a delegate to previous party congresses. There's people who work for delivery apps, also have been members of party congresses. There's been street cleaners who've been members of the party congress. But it really starts with like membership in the Communist Party, and then kind of working your way up there as a representative of larger and larger bodies.
Fei-Yung, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what this era of Chinese leadership under Xi, what are the defining characteristics of it? Is there something particular to Xi as a leader that distinguishes the direction that China has taken under him? And then in addition to that, I see a lot of China watchers saying that the 20th Party Congress appointments display like a consolidation of power under Xi and lean towards, you know, loyalists. Do you think that this is a correct analysis, or is there anything about this that is kind of misleading?
Yeah, so I think that a lot of this is really just driven by like the growth of China and where China is relative to the United States versus, like, say 20 or 30 years ago, and that the framing of China as like a threat, like to the American way of life, or as a peer competitor, that has also kind of colored the coverage about Xi. I think if we were to go back to, say, 1993, and we looked at Jiang's appointments, you could probably say that, like, oh, Jiang is supporting himself, surrounding himself with supporters too. Oh, he's only appointing loyalists. So that's why I don't think that coverage is really that accurate. But I'd also want to take a step back and see this not really just like about Xi, the person, but the era that China is in is also just a continuation of China's like kind of arc, as you'd say, since 1949. And if I wanted to lay this out in very basic terms, I'd say like the Mao era is the founding of China. It's rebuilding from like World War II as well as the Civil War. There's a lot of like, there's a lot of progress made there in terms of life expectancy, basic like socialist infrastructure, but the country is still largely undeveloped. There were some attempts to like try to quickly industrialize that didn't work out. And so what Deng did after he came to power, and there's a Hua Guofeng in between, but he was there pretty briefly. But Deng's era, you know, is pretty well known, at least in leftist circles, or even broadly as like China's opening up. Some people call this like China's capitalistic turn or whatever. But what's important is that like he kind of opened China up, said, hey, we're willing to like trade with more of the world. We're willing to accept some like foreign investment. But honestly, Deng did not loosen that much. Like it's not some like outpouring. This is where all the outsourcing started. Like at first it was pretty limited to a couple of special economic zones, but it did kick off like the China's like integration with the world. And then you get to, the late 80s, there's like a small inflation crisis in China that it is one of the factors leading up to 1989. But, after that, then it's Jiang. And Jiang's, I think his term really is dominated by the negotiations on China to join the World Trade Organization, which was an absolutely critical moment for China because it just unlocked so many doors in terms of integration with the world, trade opportunities, manufacturing that wasn't available without World Trade Center membership. And that was a huge bet on behalf of China, because those were very tough negotiations. Actually, the premier of China, when Zhu Rongji, when he came back from the negotiations and the people saw like, oh, all the concessions he had to make, he was absolutely like roasted in the press. They're like, oh, Zhu Rongji's a traitor to the country. He's just giving everything away to the West just so we can get into the World Trade Organization. And, you know, China joined the WTO in 2001, and it was a pretty rough transition. Like, there was a lot of layoffs at some state-owned enterprises as part of like this accession. It was a lot of people in the northeast of China like were laid off, and that kind of began this kind of large labor transfer of workers from the north and northeast of China to like the coasts and to southern China, which is also part of like this outsourcing of manufacturing to China. And so that's when Hu Jintao took power. He was basically the guy in charge during China's transition to like post World Trade Organization China. And that's a very difficult position for any leader to be in. So I do think like a lot of the negative things that cropped up during his time, like the especially corruption in the party, you know, it's those things are also kind of inevitable with like the big shock that China was going through. And, you know, they managed it reasonably well. But the Xi era, which started in about like 2012, I see that really as like, okay, now we've done our integration. Now we're in the WTO. Now we've built up productive forces. We have some leverage. We have some power now. Now it's time to start reining in those market excesses. And Xi just happens to be that person who is in charge to take control of this pivot and to make sure that that's implemented. You know, in his first couple of focuses, in the first kind of say 5 years of Xi, it might be ancient history to people now, but two of the big focuses were cracking down on corrupt officials and also pollution. Like it was only like maybe 10 years ago that you'd see all these images of like Beijing covered in smog, you know, that go all the way down to your knees and just absolute zero visibility. Like they cleared that up in just like a couple of years. It's actually kind of an amazing achievement in retrospect, but that the environment and then corruption, those were the primary focuses for the new administration then. And, you know, they had some massive achievements there. And it's also at this time that like kind of the eye of Sauron, the eye of Washington, D.C., kind of the focus more on China. There's Obama's pivot to Asia. There's Trump, who's also about China, all about China. And even this current administration, which is a continuation of that. And so all that extra attention from the Western press on China has kind of shaped this narrative that she's this big, bad, authoritarian guy who's come in just to take control. But, you know, it just doesn't fit in with what his early priorities are and like the priorities facing China right now. He's like, let's rein in the excesses of the market. Now the U.S. is like doing all these things to us. We need to be able to respond to that. We need to be able to protect ourselves from that. So that's how I see all this fitting in. And a lot of the policies that were discussed at the Party Congress, I think, fit really neatly into this framework as well.
Thank you for that. One of the things that I hear a lot is about Xi Jinping thought. And, you know, I think for Westerners, we probably don't have a good idea if, you know, unless we have read his works, what exactly that means. What distinguishes Xi Jinping thought from, you know, his predecessors, or how does it fit into kind of the direction that China is taking now as it kind of returns more towards some of its Marxist roots and tries to rein in the excesses of capital following this period of growth and expansion?
In responding to the sudden outbreak of COVID-19, we put the people and their lives above all else and tenaciously pursue a dynamic zero-COVID policy. In launching an all-out people's war to stop the spread of the virus, we have protected the people's health and safety to the greatest extent possible and made tremendous encouraging achievements in both epidemic response and economic and social development. In the face of turbulent developments in Hong Kong, the central government exercises overall jurisdiction over the special administrative regions as prescribed by China's constitution and basic law of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region and ensure that Hong Kong is administered by patriots. Thanks to these moves, orders have been restored in Hong Kong, marking a major turn for the better in the region. In response to separatist activities aimed at Taiwan independence and gross provocations of external interference in Taiwan affairs, we have resolutely fought against separatism and counter-interference, demonstrating our resolve and ability to safeguard China's sovereignty and territorial integrity and to oppose Taiwan independence.
I'd say that like basically every leader of China has kind of had like a term or like a phrase associated with them, and then like this is their representative like contribution to the body of, you know, socialism with Chinese characteristics. Like for Jiang, it was the three represents. For Hu, it was like the scientific outlook on development, and like for Xi, I guess it's, you know, for in Western like media, it's very unelegantly like Xi Jinping thought, but like the actual policy prescriptions are really just like, okay, we've joined the WTO, we've built up these productive forces, now it's created all of these other problems that we now need to address with, and how are we going to tackle those? And that's really what the thrust of like these key terms have been for me.
I think we get a sort of distorted view of, you know, what is happening in the National Party Congress from the Western press, which tends to focus on imperial intrigue, palace intrigue happening, you know, within the Communist Party. And it's sort of dramatized. What is your perspective about kind of why the U.S. covers, Chinese leadership and especially the National Congress in the fashion that it's been doing?
You know, part of it is just a symptom of our 24/7 news cycle. And because we get a lot of those kind of dramatic moments in American politics, like Pelosi's method of clapping after a State of the Union speech, you know, that's national news. What color jumpsuits people are wearing, like it's what color of ties, things like that get a lot of coverage here. And they look for parallels and equivalents in Chinese politics. Like there was a lot of coverage on how many cups of tea Xi Jinping had in front of him, how many sips he was taking, like the timing of that. Barring that, they go to things like word count. How many times was Marxism mentioned? How many times was common prosperity mentioned? They did get their payoff with the when Hu Jintao was kind of like escorted out of the Congress, due to being unwell. And that was like a huge moment for everyone, right? There's a storm of think pieces. Like, what does this mean? Was he being purged in front of everyone? And if you go back now and you look at Bloomberg and some of the other coverage there, it's a lot more like walked back. It's like, yeah, he probably was unwell. Yeah, they probably didn't mean to purge him. But you know, it's all the coverage is already out there, and I think that's really just Americans looking for easily digestible, exciting things to put as the headlines for the Congress. Like, you know, that CNN is not going to highlight to you that, oh, China reiterates its carbon neutral goals by 2060, right? Like, Americans aren't going to be interested in that unless you really hype that up, right? So there's a reason they don't want to cover that. And also, you know, it's positive news about China, and we see very little of that today too.
I think that's true. There's sort of very little focus on the actual content of the party congress, or, you know, the structure of how the political process functions in China. It's kind of all left behind this sort of mystification of the process and focus on, you know, what sort of nefarious things might be happening. And, you know, I think there's sort of broad disagreement within the left as to, you know, how people characterize the nature of China's political system, you know, whether it is socialist or capitalist or authoritarian. And I think it's interesting to see the extent to which that description shifts, you know, for kind of like a more business audience. Bloomberg or The Economist or Wall Street Journal has no problem describing China as being, you know, Marxist, because that's sort of the scary word for, you know, for China to that audience. And then, you know, to a more left-leaning audience, you know, China is authoritarian and a human rights violator and, you know, not socialist. So I think the description sort of shifts based on, you know, who the expected audience is, with the through point that, you know, China is being cast, I think, in a negative light. But I'm curious if you can talk a little bit about whether DSA as an organization has an official position on China's political system.
Yeah, I definitely agree with like the examples you described. China's kind of a chimera that can be anything you want it to be in America, because there's not a lot of familiarity with China. You know, you can frame it in the negative to whatever audience you want, knowing like what this audience cares about, right? There's something for everyone there. But I think that's something that really can only be solved with more education. And, you know, while DSA's priorities aren't really taking a position on the nature of the Communist Party of China, its primary focus is on like de-escalation of this Cold War that is ramping up by the United States and United States aggression toward China and other countries. And I think that's absolutely the right focus. You know, as DSA is a U.S.-based organization, it's incumbent on us to first and foremost challenge like our government's policies here. But I'd also encourage like listeners, like DSA or not, to explore more about Chinese policies and the actual impacts of them, what they're saying, because they're very actually transparent about their goals here. Like the party congress documents, like, hey, here are policy goals and focuses for the next 5 years. Like, don't let CNN tell you this is what China's going to do. Like, they put it out there. It's translated for the most part. You can read it. You can read about their environmental goals. You can read about what they're doing with like solar power, what they're doing with healthcare, what they're doing with like drug negotiations. And
the past decade marked three major events of great immediate importance and profound historical significance for the cause of the party and the people. We embraced the centenary of the Communist Party of China. We ushered in a new era of socialism with Chinese characteristics, and we eradicated absolute poverty and finished building a moderately prosperous society in all respects, thus completing the first centenary goal. These were historical feats accomplished by the Communist Party of China and the Chinese people striving in unity, feats that will be forever recorded in the Chinese nation's history, and feats that will be profoundly influenced the world. A decade ago, this was the situation we faced. Great achievements had been secured in reform and opening up, and socialism mobilization, and notable advances had been made in the great new projects of party building. All this had created solid foundations, favorable conditions, and key underpinning for our continued progress. At the same time, however, a number of prominent issues and problems, some of which have been building for years and others which were just emerging, demanded urgent actions. In the face of these acute problems and challenges which undermine the party's long-term governance, the security and stability of our country, and the well-being of the people, the Party's Central Committee fully assessed the situation, made resolute decisions, and took firm steps. Under its leadership, the entire party, the military, and the Chinese people were brought together. We rolled up our sleeves and got down to work, forging ahead with resolve to carry out the great struggle with many new features of our times. Over the past decade, we have stayed committed to Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong thought, Deng Xiaoping theory, the theory of three represents, and the scientific outlook on development. We have fully implemented the thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era, as well as the party's basic line and the basic policy.
I think on a lot of these things, ironically, it's the business press that is the most honest about this, like Financial Times, Bloomberg. They're the ones that will tell you, hey, it's really awful that China is using its leverage to negotiate lower prices with, big pharma. That's really cutting into our profits. It's not good that China is like locking down a factory for COVID. That's really going to affect Apple production, right? So those things, you know, like they're framing that in the negative, but they also have to be a little bit more honest there because their readers, like investors, funds, et cetera, they do rely on them for accurate information. Now they care about it from a different perspective than you and I might, but, the information is out there. You know, I encourage you to go out there and read up more about it rather than just let, you know, the headlines tell you what's going on.
Right. It's almost as if, you know, you could get a little shuffle button and just randomly assign somebody, despite their own ideological standpoint, some information about China. They might get something actually more accurate, I think, than the sort of tailor-made propaganda, I think, that comes kind of out of the U.S. about China. Now, DSA is an organization. We have, you know, a platform that is voted on by our delegates to our convention. And one of the parts of our platform in terms of foreign policy is to de-escalate a Cold War with China. This is a, you know, officially adopted part of TSA's national platform. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, why does DSA think it is important to avoid a Cold War with China? And what are some of the costs of the U.S. pursuing this hostile posture towards China, particularly at this juncture in time? To me, I think about the sort of short runway that we have with climate change, the risks of, you know, a world war, particularly with the U.S. posture right now towards Russia. It feels to me like this is a time where we can kind of ill afford this type of escalation. What can you say about that?
Yeah, like I think climate change is a great example, but also just pandemic response too. Like these are things that if there was more room for cooperation between China and the United States, there's a lot of great things that could happen. But instead, you know, it's like from the start, the U.S. pandemic response was like, don't trust anything coming out of China. Like we don't need their aid. We don't need their like masks or anything like that. It's a pity. Like there's a lot of real impact on people's lives because we're so intent on this escalation, ensuring that like the U.S. remains top dog of this like dunghill. It's fine if the dunghill's smaller, as long as we're still number one. It seems to be the mentality. And that really hamstrings cooperation on things like climate change or pandemic response, or just also a lot of money that could be going to other things just spent on like deals going to defense contractors. And, you know, once that starts getting baked into to Lockheed's earnings, like, hey, investors are going to have to pressure Lockheed, like, well, you had some great earnings last quarter. How are you going to keep those up? And the only way that these defense contractors can keep up that level of spending is like, well, we got to keep escalating the threat. And so there's just no real incentive out there for politicians to kind of de-escalate the Cold War here. You know, there's not a lot of money in that. And so that's why it's even more important for people like you and I to get educated and to be aware of, you know, what's actually going on.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, the pressure to de-escalate these conflicts is not going to come from defense contractors. It's not going to come, you know, from the think tankosphere, which is often funded by, at least partially, also defense contractors, the State Department. There's a lot of linkages there between the national security state and the U.S. And think tanks, as well as the media. And there's sort of like this, you know, cohesive body that moves kind of like, you know, towards a more and more aggressive posture towards China. But, you know, when I sort of study the statements about it coming out of China, what I see consistently being spoken about is that this escalation is not something that China wants. Although I think it's portrayed in the Western press as a mutual escalation, that's kind of not how I perceive it, just sort of like observing like what the actual escalations are on each side. I think China is, you know, very much prepared to defend itself and won't be pushed around by the United States. But maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, how China would like to be relating to the U.S. and to, you know, to the West in general.
Yeah. So, you know, China, like, used to be basically the place where you could mass produce cheap goods like plastic injection molding, toys, things like that. And that suited the United States very well, right? Like, it's a source of cheap labor and cheap goods to subsidize American lifestyles. Now, China, like, they don't want to be stuck there forever, right? Like, every country wants to move up the value chain to enrich its people and to basically like build up its own capabilities. And so as soon as China wanted to basically keep moving up the value chain, like, okay, we can make these toys, but hey, we can make cars too. We can make phones. We can make, you know, a lot of other things. And as China started doing that and started really improving in like software and AI and semiconductors, like, that's where the U.S. decided like, oh, wait, you know, that's too much of that. You know, we don't actually want you. We like you where you are, you know. One particular point and example is trash. Like, China used to be the export destination for a lot of our recycling. And it would just basically get packed up here and shipped over to China and then, you know, let them sort it out. They can see what's recyclable and what's not. And then China said, like, hey, that's actually producing a ton of plastic pollution. We don't want them anymore. We don't need to do that anymore. And so they just basically stopped taking U.S. exports of trash. And the U.S. response was that we're very unhappy that China is disrupting traditional supply chains, is what they said. And, you know, I think that's just basically playing out on a larger level here, where like the U.S. is now like fully bought into constraining China's development. Like, they say it out loud, like, hey, we can't let China be able to produce like high-end semiconductors. We can't let China be able to produce like these advanced AI computing machines, things like that. And so, you know, that's obviously not what China wants. Like, this has forced China to try and build out a lot of these things domestically, build out U.S.-free development, supply chain, things like that. Like, it's going to take longer, but that's that's the only option left to them. And I don't think they'd prefer to do that. I think they'd prefer to be able to like operate and deal with the U.S. like, you know, in a, I don't want to say normal, but like in a less constrained way.
Yeah, that's the sense that I get as well, you know, reading statements from the government in China, is that that they prefer a system of, you know, international cooperation, you know, that can be competitive, but isn't necessarily hostile and aggressive. From my own perspective, you know, I try to think about, you know, why the U.S. is adopting this posture. I mean, sure, we know that the U.S. has had a period of near total hegemonic control over the global financial system, a very, you know, powerful military that it's used to invade countries all over the world. But, you know, is the U.S. opposition to China, is it ideological? I suppose that people's perception of that, you know, varies to some degree based on what they believe the nature of China's political system is. You know, is it about control? I think that the U.S., you know, uses its dominance over the world financial system to put sanctions on nations that are, you know, uncooperative with U.S. policy, or pose, you know, what it perceives to be a threat to U.S. interests. And to what extent does China's rise represent a challenge to broader U.S. control, not just, you know, over China, but over other nations as well?
Yeah, so it's, you know, that kind of challenge to the way China is seen as a challenge to the U.S. is there's something for everyone. There's definitely a lot of people in the U.S. government that, like, ideologically see China as, like, a, you know, a Marxist state, and, like, that's not something that we can abide. There's people who are in the government that are probably a little bit more, like, realpolitik-focused, and they just don't want to see a peer competitor to the United States emerge, and that's why in the 80s, the U.S. also dealt with the rising Japan, too, with the Plaza Accord, and made sure that Japan couldn't overtake the U.S. in certain industries. So, like, the – sorry, could you repeat the second part of your question? I kind of got lost there.
You know, what it is about China's rise,
oh,
it's not
right. –
to me, it's not just, you know, yeah, about China being a threat directly in and of itself, developing and becoming more powerful, but the way that it enables other countries, you know,
So we've seen that with,
you know, what the U.S. would call invading U.S. sanctions.
Yeah, we've seen that with a couple of countries before, like North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, where, you know, China has said that, oh, they're evading unilateral U.S. sanctions by trading with these countries. In fact, like Huawei working with Iran was the supposed reason that the U.S. had Canada detain the CFO of Huawei as she was getting on a plane to go back to China. So that's definitely a concern for the U.S. Like they want to use sanctions as this like extremely powerful tool for compliance with other countries. And it doesn't help that if China's just going to ignore those. So that's definitely like, I wouldn't say it's a primary issue, but it is one of the issues that like China has, the U.S. has with China's rise. I think on another more macro level, there's also just the emergence of a country that has become prosperous. It's built itself up that hasn't kind of gone that IMF shock therapy, like capitalist route, like the earlier, like Asian tigers did, like Singapore, South Korea, et cetera. Like, that's the model that the U.S. is comfortable with, because that's ultimately still under the U.S. umbrella. You know, and honestly, I don't care if it succeeds or not. Later, there's been examples of IMF shock therapy all across the world, and most of those are failures. And that's fine with the U.S. Like, they're perfectly willing to keep trying it and having it keep fail. Because that's not really a challenge to like the U.S.'s ruling ideology or its like hegemony over the rest of the world. But an emergence of China, which hasn't followed any of those rules, which isn't part of that system, you know, that's very concerning to the U.S. And that's why you also see the U.S. now starting to kind of back away from these global institutions that it set up. Like now the United Nations, that's under Chinese control. The World Health Organization, that's under Chinese control. We got to pull out of all those, right? You know, there's mostly also like a Trump thing, but there also is a lot of growing unease that, hey, we don't dominate these global institutions like we used to. There are new ones emerging, like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS, that we aren't a part of. And, you know, the U.S. is very concerned about that.
Yeah, I think that is definitely true. There is sort of an unease, I think, on a fundamental level with a model that is not, you know, a pure capitalist, profit-driven liberal democracy ascending within the global system, because then once again, there's a tension of, you know, what kind of model of development our country is going to, you know, that our developing nations going to follow. Are they going to aspire to be another United States or something, you know, like the countries cast kind of in the U.S. image and within the U.S. orbit? Or are they going to mark off on kind of their own path of development, as China has done? And I think that this poses kind of a deep insecurity to the U.S. ruling class to some extent, which I think, you know, is an interesting problem to grapple with, because I don't think it's just about China becoming a big, powerful nation. It's also a model that is kind of very deeply opposed to how things are structured in the West. What are your thoughts about, you know, this is the sort of like forward looking, but do you feel that other nations, you know, might become inspired by China's independence or model of development moving forward?
There definitely are. I think like for developing countries, there's always going to be interest in like, hey, how did China do it? What are things that we can borrow from that model that, you know, worked for them and could work for us? I know he's controversial, but Paul Kagame in Rwanda, he's spoken about that pretty openly a couple of times. You hear some of it in South America too, or in Southeast Asia. There's definitely like for countries outside of the West, there's definitely a lot of interest in seeing like how we can replicate parts of the Chinese model and make it work for us. Now, like even China would say that like it's not something that you can simply just copy, right? Like you have to build something that works for your own domestic conditions, but there's definitely a lot of interest to see like, hey, they managed to do it without, like, you know, the IMF or like the Western model. What can we learn from that?
I could see how that would just be sort of destabilizing to kind of global economic relations, you know, that have occurred kind of since colonialism to the present time. If nations sort of start striking out in development paths that, you know, are not just about neoliberal reforms and allowing foreign companies to come in and privatize, but instead taking, you know, control over their own national resources and using them to the benefit of their people, which I think, you know, China's poverty alleviation program is an interesting example of, you know, how development can be oriented towards lifting people out of poverty. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about, you know, how that program has been successful. China, you know, I believe it was last year, announced that they had eradicated extreme poverty within the country, and what sort of an achievement that represents.
Yeah, so it's an incredible achievement. And I think like the really that last mile of it is just down to geography. Like the last couple of places with extreme poverty, it's kind of in the hinterlands, like up in the mountains, like in central China or in southwest China and Guizhou. Like there's just a lot of villages up there in the mountains that like it's very difficult to reach. There hasn't been infrastructure built out, and a lot of this like poverty alleviation is building that infrastructure, like connecting these people to the electrical grid, or just making sure that there are roads that can reach them, et cetera, making sure there's like access to schools, education. But all of that stuff, like it's not easy to do. These are places that honestly could have just been left behind. Like if there's like a more neoliberal China would just like, well, who cares? You know, like they're fine. They're not a priority. But it's, you know, it's very important to me that like China is spending the time and effort to do this, even though like it's not something that's going to like deliver a bunch of economic growth. It's not something that's, you know, going to significantly enhance China's defense capabilities or anything like that. It's simply like, hey, this is our responsibility to the Chinese people. We got to go out. We got to build these roads. We got to get these people access to the grids. We got to make sure they have access to like the same education. And there's not a lot of energy for that, I think, in many other countries. Like in the U.S., you know, like Cairo, Illinois, it's a town that's falling apart in southern Illinois. And man, there's just no energy for places like that in the U.S. They're just kind of let to kind of rot on their own. And that's really sad to see.
Yeah, I'm struck by the fact that, you know, there was that Harvard study about trust in government, that it was actually higher in the provincial and, you know, kind of more rural areas, which I think probably speaks to that effort to invest in those areas. And it's hard to imagine here, you know, a political program that is really driven by what people need versus, you know, increasing profits to corporations with kind of a blind eye to, you know, how that impacts society as a whole. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the direction that China is taking growth-wise when it comes to the environment, because there's this tension between, you know, poverty alleviation and growth and the consumption of resources and the, you know, need to reduce carbon outputs because of the sort of looming climate disaster. Is there something you can tell us about, you know, where China is going to take that, you know, in terms of their engagement with the BRI or with other nations? You know, how do they see development progressing under these constraints?
Yeah, so that's definitely something that's come more into focus like these last couple of years versus when the Belt and Road Initiative initially launched. But like in the last few years, China announced its peak carbon target and its like carbon neutral target, which is carbon neutral, I believe, is 2060. And they reiterated those goals at the Party Congress. So it shows that they're still committed to those, even though like, you know, economic growth across the world and in China has been slowing. There definitely is like a desire to like, well, maybe we can do more to grow faster. But they're still prioritizing the environment there. And in terms of the Belt and Road, there's also been a lot more focus on like, let's make sure that we're developing green projects. We're focusing on developing like solar power and things like that. And these projects that we're funding too. So I think that's definitely a shift that's coming that wasn't there when the Belt and Road initially launched, but it's good to see that that's also being factored in now.
I'm always kind of impressed with how quickly China pivots on major issues. You know, you can see that in terms of their COVID response, and that's sort of like a flexibility and ability to direct massive state resources and the resources, you know, that they can drum up amongst the population to dealing with particular problems that I feel like we just sort of don't have in the West. You know, our system is very sluggish and unresponsive and kind of stuck to, you know, supporting the, you know, corporate benefactors and donors who kind of pay for our system. So I think it's really going to be interesting to see how China meets a lot of these challenges that we're all going to be facing over the decades to come. Do you have any sort of final thoughts about, you know, what this particular 20th Party Congress tells us about the direction that China is going to be taking?
I to me, it's like a reiteration of what they've been doing. It's like a commitment to stay the course, and there's not like any major pivot signaled, which is, you know, probably a little different from the coverage that says, oh, this is a more hawkish China or a more aggressive China. It's really focused on like, hey, we're focusing on like regulating wealth accumulation, common prosperity, our carbon neutral targets, and also reiteration of like longstanding Chinese policy on Taiwan too. But that's basically like the confirmation of like we're going to continue in this direction for the next 5 years.
Well, thank you, Fei-Yang, for all of that insight. It was really, I think, valuable for folks in the U.S. and in the West to learn more about what the CPC 20th Congress indicates for China's direction in the future, and how, you know, we should be looking more deeply into how the system itself functions rather than just relying on the headlines coming out of our press.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.